This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, presidential elections are scheduled for Alphaville this weekend. Rumors are circulating the election is going to be rigged. It's uncertain what this means for future elections since Alphaville only exists online. Virtual communities, who plays them, and how they interact with the real world, that's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. The baseball season is finally underway here in the States. Last week, the New York Yankees and the Tampa Bay Devil Rays played two games in Tokyo, which introduced American fans to breakfast baseball, a regular habit for millions in Japan who wake up to watch their countrymen play ball in the major leagues. Since American professors introduced baseball to Japan in the Meiji era, about 1870, the country has been hooked on America's national pastime. Though some ventured before him, Hideo Nomo led the way for a new wave of Japanese ballplayers to hit the big leagues. Ichiro in Seattle, Matsui for the Yankees, just to name a couple. Not all Japanese players succeed here, and success does not necessarily lead to love from fans or the press in either Japan or the United States. If you have questions about the history of Japanese ballplayers lured to baseball in the United States, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. Robert Whiting joins us now from our bureau in New York to talk about the cultural divisions and similarities. He's the author of the newly published The Meaning of Ichiro, The New Wave from Japan and the Transformation of Our National Pastime. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Just a few other Japanese players before 1995 tried to make it in the States. I guess the first Japanese ball player to make it was Murakami Masanori, whom you dubbed the accidental pioneer. How come he didn't hang on for longer?
Well, he was just sent as part of a training program, an exchange between the Nankai Hawks of Osaka and the Pacific League and the San Francisco Giants. The idea was he would go to the U.S., play in the U.S. minor leagues and then come back after a couple of years and be a better pitcher for that. And no one ever expected that he would be called up to the major leagues. There was an option clause that said the Giants could buy him for $10,000 if they brought him up. The Hawks never thought that would happen in a million years. And there's this school of thought, that says that they couldn't understand the contract they signed in the first place. So anyway, Murakami signed a contract that he couldn't read. The Giants sent $10,000 to the Hawks, and they said, Murakami's our property. Then Murakami's father got involved. He found out his son was dating a blonde-haired stewardess in San Francisco, and this is just something that he wasn't going to put up with, and a big international incident followed, and one thing led to another, and Murakami eventually wound up back in Japan. But it was a kind of a fluke. It was an accident. The Japanese have a reserve clause, much like the old reserve clause in Major League Baseball, that controls players' movements.
So that's why they're tied to their team for so long, and why Mr. Matsui of the Yankees, for example, played so long in Japan, played out his contract and his reserve clause, and then was able to move.
Well, what happened was there was a loophole in the Japanese player's contract that Don Nomura, who was the agent for Hideo Nomo, found. Voluntary retirement loophole. In the major leagues, if a player voluntarily retires and decides he wants to come back and play, he has to go with his old team, which owns worldwide rights. But in Japan, their contract was copied from a 1930s minor league, U.S. minor league contract that said nothing about worldwide rights. And Nomura found this loophole that said a Japanese player can voluntarily retire and go to the States. And that's what Nomo did. And it caused a big scandal at the time. And they had to rewrite the basic agreement between the U.S. and Japan as a result. But that's what initially opened up the doors.
Well, Nomo was a real pioneer in a lot of ways.
Yes. He was called a troublemaker, an ingrate. He resisted. He had a sore arm, and his manager ordered him to pitch through the pain. They believed the best way to cure a sore arm was to go out and throw a couple hundred pitches a day.
This was in Japan, right?
In Japan. So he refused to do that. And he had all sorts of trouble, and so he decided he was going to go to the States, and he was going to find a way, and he did find a way. But as soon as he became a star in America, the people stopped calling him a troublemaker. All of a sudden, he became, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Now, why is it that, I mean, the salaries are not all that different. In fact, a lot of Japanese players took a cut in salary to come play in the major leagues in the United States. Why do Japanese ballplayers do it?
The challenge. Hideki Matsui was offered a $64 million contract by the Yomiuri Giants last year for 6 years. It's over $10 million a year, and he turned it down to sign a three-year, $21 million deal with the Yankees. He wanted to prove that he could do it. Ichiro did the same thing. He took less money. He was making like $6 million a year when he was playing for the Oryx Blue Wave, and he signed for a $12 million three-year pact with Seattle. They just wanted to play against the best.
There's also, as you mentioned, Nomo's complaints about the way his manager required him to fix his sore arm. Japanese baseball is very different from American baseball.
Well, the Japanese turned it into a martial art. There's this school, the first higher school of Tokyo in the 1890s, that defeated a team of Americans in Yokohama, traders and missionaries. It was the first formal games ever played between America and Japan. And the Japanese won. The Japanese team won, all of them, by scores of 29-4, 35-9. And they had turned baseball into a martial art, where adopted the philosophy of the martial art of, endless training year-round, morning and night, perfectionism, development of spirit, obedience, self-sacrifice, based on the code of Bushido from which the martial arts evolved. And these victories had a huge impact. They were reported on the front page of the newspapers, and Japan had just opened up after several centuries of isolation. They were trying to catch up to the more industrially advanced West, and they thought, well, if we can beat the Americans at their own game, then surely we can surpass them in other fields of industry as well.
Yet that same regimentation makes it difficult for more individualistic ballplayers to stick it out.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yes, sure. I've got a cold and jet lag here. I just flew in from Tokyo.
I was saying, you saw those games that the Yankees and the Devil Rays played in Japan, right?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes.
So your condition is we should take a note of your condition and maybe not go to see the Yankees and the Devil Rays when they play tonight in Tampa.
Well, I think Derek Jeter probably feels about the same way I do right now.
Yeah, so, I bet he does. Anyway, getting back to the questions, if you would like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Keith, who joins us from Napa, California.
Hi, this is Keith. I teach U.S. history at a JC in Napa. I was in Korea, so I got to observe Korean major leagues. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about them.
Well, go ahead. Do they take the same attitude as the Japanese do, a martial arts approach to it?
I'm not so sure about that, but they're very, very serious about it. I went to a couple games. They love it. One thing was that Park Chan-ho, who we call Chan-ho Park, who was originally with the Dodgers, I was for a while in the town he grew up in, which is Gwangju. And when he would pitch for the Dodgers, half the nation would stay up all night to watch.
Right.
You know, national hero. And there'd be billboards around town with him and his grandfather, who was some sort of Confucian sage. So right. It was really amazing. They love it. They're good. In terms of description of the games themselves, the outfields were dirt because it's much colder in Korea than Japan, so it's in March and April, it's still pretty cold.
Well, they use a lot of artificial fields in Japan, don't they, Robert?
Yes, they do. There's several domes and a lot of artificial grass, and the players complain about that because it's bad on their knees. In fact, Matsui actually said that's one of the reasons why he wanted to leave Japan, because the Tokyo Dome was too hard on his body.
Well, we got to watch Japanese baseball on TV, so I was getting Japanese, American, and Korean baseball on cable.
It's also a big league in Taiwan.
Yes, but I'll let you guys go on, but a quick description of a game. Each team was allowed two foreign players, which they called mercenaries, and it usually ended up to be one African-American guy and one white guy. I think that was random. And they would, instead of what we eat at baseball games, hot dogs and popcorns and stuff, they would eat dried cuttlefish. And they had really cute cheerleaders who would dance to Korean techno music. So that's my description. Thank you for the show.
Thanks, Keith. Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. Our guest is Robert Whiting. He's the author of the newly published The Meaning of Ichiro. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we've heard a lot about the difficulties that American ballplayers going over to Japan have had. I guess there was a Tom Selleck movie of that Mr. Baseball a few years ago describing that. And we've read stories about the situation that a guy like Tuffy Rhodes, who's a big home run American, who's a big home run hitter in the Japanese leagues, faces. You write a lot about the difficulties that Japanese ballplayers have adapting to American culture.
Yes, they all. It's almost a mirror of what the Americans do in Japan. They form their own little sub-communities, and when they go on their road, they go to Japanese clubs. They're served drinks by Japanese hostesses, college students there working part-time. They eat at Japanese restaurants. To a man, they hate Kansas City because there are no good Japanese restaurants there. There's this sort of sense of isolation. Shinjo was telling me one time, he's a guy who used to play for the Mets, that he said by the time the game is over, all the restaurants are closed, and all you is to do is to go back to your room and order a cheeseburger and watch television you can't understand. A cheeseburger you can't eat and TV you don't understand. So there's some discrimination. Some of the wives complain about that. And when Nomo first came over, he used to get letters, why don't you go home, Yellow Monkey? And some fans at Shea Stadium were saying, go home, Jap. But on the other hand, Ichiro said that he had never experienced anything like that, really. He said that he lived in a protective cocoon. And the worst thing that anybody ever said to him was a group of fans at Yankee Stadium who were yelling wasabi at him. Wasabi is this kind of Japanese mustard.
Well, it was a punchline of a commercial at the time you may have missed since you were in Japan.
Yeah.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Tom, who's on the phone with us from Columbus, Ohio.
That's right. First-time caller. Love your show.
Thank you.
I lived in Asia a few years back, and the American men in our part of our community wanted to start our own little league, and the reason being was that we wanted to teach the kids the way we all grew up with it, and our only option was the Japanese there, and it was not in Japan, but who controlled it, and the gentleman on the show there is absolutely right. It's martial arts type of baseball that they had Williamsport on their mind and nothing else. That was the only focus, and we wanted
Williamsport, the home of the Little League World Series, of course.
Exactly. I mean, they really had a goal, and our goal was to teach the kids and have a coffee Saturday morning when we had the opportunity to be with the kids and do it in a much more laid-back fashion. And so there is quite a difference for sure.
Well, Robert Whiting, tell us a little bit about Ichiro's father. You write about him in the book.
Right. Well, in regard to this, what the caller just said, it's true. Little League in Japan is played year-round, where in the States it's a seasonal thing to do. Ichiro's father, when he was 3 years old, bought him a baseball glove that cost nearly $300, the most expensive baseball glove available on the market, red leather. He brought it home, and his mother had a heart attack almost, and he said, why are you spending so much money on a toy? And the father said, this is not a toy, it's a tool of education. The father was a practicing Buddhist / Shintoist who believed that all inanimate things had souls, and that that his son had to learn to show respect for them at an early age. He would take his son out and play catch with him with his new shiny new glove, and at night, every night, he made Ichiro oil and clean the glove as a sign of respect and gratitude for the service that provided him. And that started this daily practice that continued throughout their life. Even now, after games in Seattle, Ichiro will clean his glove and oil it, and it really upsets him when he puts it down on the bench next to him and somebody like Brett Boone comes along and sits on it. It's really a lack of
Respect.
Decorum and respect for equipment, yes. Yeah.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Robert Whiting, we appreciate your time today. Hope your cold gets better.
Thank you.
Robert Whiting was in our New York bureau. His new book is The Meaning of Ichiro, The New Way from Japan, and the Transformation of Our National Pastime.